We hope and trust that you will find this Torah in Motion program meaningful. Through these programs, Torah in Motion encourages discussion, debate, and education about the most important issues facing Jews and Judaism today. Together, we can focus on creating religious commitment through an honest and sophisticated encounter with topics that are relevant to being Jewish in the modern world. For more information about this and other Torah in Motion programs, please visit the website at www.torahinmotion.org.
Take a cup of coffee or drinks while we do that. That's okay, but I don't want to take an official break. Okay, thank you. Whatever you prefer.
I think I'll sit down. More of a feeling of panel. I have a small enough room. People can hear me?
Yes. We'll get you a mic.
I'm moving my point here.
I'd just like to thank Rabbi Lapin for his presentation, which I enjoyed very much. When I put the case study together, I didn't know that it would be such a, as Rabbi Lapin pointed out, a current event. I'm just going to read the case study. This is an actual question which reached our column. Of course, I always change identifying details, names, exact the business, and men and women, and so on. But this is an actual question that which we dealt with in our column. It's a whistleblowing case. John is a star employee at a government contractor, a high executive, a very effective one. The careless leadership style of the CEO Loretta cost the government millions of dollars. Talking about a person who is not engaging in something which we could identify as criminal, but at the same time is something which is definitely improper. It's careless, and the customer, in this case the government, would certainly be upset about it. When John suggests ways to rectify the situation, he's amply rewarded by being fired, right? We know that this is the usual situation. Rabbi Lapin already pointed that out to us. And now John has set up his own competing firm, a common outcome, and is contemplating blowing the whistle and ready to stop reimagining practice. He's going to go and tell the customer, he's going to tell the government that all these shenanigans are going on, which he is certain will lead to her losing all her contracts, which he will then be able to scoop up, or finding a friend who will do it for him. This was in fact the case. It's a classic whistleblowing case where it doesn't have the life and death aspects of many whistleblowing cases, which would make obviously the analysis much simpler. I think it is a much more interesting case because it's it's not a case of someone trying a life or death case. It has an interesting balance between, on the one hand, it would be proper to let the customer know, the government know that something's being happening. On the other hand, there's an addictive aspect here, and that will go on, I think, in a discussion. We're going to start the discussion at a very basic level, I think, talk about whistleblowing in general, and later on get more into the details. What I mainly want to say about whistleblowing is that, as far as I can tell, the Jewish approach to it, as far as my research has so far shown me, adopts quite a different approach, a different way of framing the question. The answers, I think, are not very different than what I've seen in the secular literature, but they seem to get to a very similar answer in a very different way. And the way that I've mostly seen the whistleblowing question phrase is a question of loyalty to the company versus loyalty to society as a whole. The person is asked or expected, or his dilemma is created by the feeling, on the one hand, he does feel his responsibility to reveal whatever wrongdoing is going on, and at the same time, he feels that he's being hired to be loyal to the company and not to snitch on them. And one thing this creates is a very marked, extreme dichotomy between the ethical obligations of someone within the company and someone without the company, where someone who does not belong to the company is not expected to have any kind of ethical obligation to the company to not blow the whistle. You know, the normal approach, as far as I know, is that a person is encouraged to blow the whistle, so to speak. Within the company, who's belonging within the company, is first encouraged to try and exhaust any internal channel for rectifying it, and only if those fail, to start worrying about ways if it's proper to let it go beyond the company. And no one expects someone from outside the company, this is a reporter or a competitor, somebody else finds out something going wrong with the company. Nobody even expects or demands that they would go and try and exhaust internal things. They're outsiders, no one expects them to have loyalty, whereas the insider is expected to have an extreme loyalty, and even after he has exhausted all the internal channels, we know that he often meets a very grim fate if he goes beyond the company. And I think that rather than reaching a different outcome, I think that Judaism looks at it in a different way, where the insider-outsider dichotomy is rather narrowed. First of all, Judaism does view a responsibility that an employee should be loyal to his employer, but the loyalty does not mean, it means he has to do a good job, he has to devote it to his workplace. It doesn't mean that he's supposed to cover up a wrongdoing, and on the contrary, the employee has a much greater obligation than someone who doesn't belong to the company to try and right the wrong. There's a very important Gemara in Shabbat, in the Talmud. Is anybody who has the ability to protest wrongdoing within his own family and he doesn't do that, then he is included for that same wrongdoing. The same thing is true. Someone who is within a city and he has the ability to protest and he doesn't, nitpas al anshei iro. He himself is included in the wrongdoing of the people of the city and so on in the whole world. A person who is part of the problem has a much, not a lesser responsibility. His loyalty is expressed in his greater responsibility to rectify the situation. So we don't see such an extreme look. Of course, the person will still have responsibility to try and do it within the company, because that's what's going to be the most effective. And we already discovered the person does not want to say Lashon Hara if he has some other way of rectifying the situation. But it's not the dilemma is not expressed in terms of the person's loyalty to the company, but rather in terms of what is the most effective way of rectifying the situation. Whereas, contrarily, someone who doesn't belong to the company, as far as I can tell, will also have at least some responsibility or some desire to try and resolve it within the company and not without, for the simple reason that, again, we're not trying to act in a vindictive way, trying to rectify the situation. If the most effective way is going to be doing that, doing it within the company without spreading any slanders beyond that, then that would also be better. Now, it's still going to be true that a person in the company has a better chance, of resolving it within than somebody who doesn't belong, and he's not going to have, someone who does not belong to the company, he's not going to have the same channels. And it's also true that someone within the company is allowed to take into consideration that he might lose his job. Judaism certainly acknowledges the importance of having employment, and a person is going to certainly be allowed to consider, on the one hand, I should be blowing the whistle, on the other hand, I might lose my livelihood. We acknowledge that, but we don't turn it into an ideal. There's a difference between acknowledging the fact that a person has to take account of the fact that he might be damaging the company, he might lose his job. Okay, life has certain realities. That's not turning it into an ideal and calling it loyalty to the employer. And so we're going to reach a very similar conclusion that someone within the company should really try and exhaust all internal channels And some of the other companies are going to have a less responsibility to do that, but it's going to come from a much different approach, not from an approach of company loyalty, but merely the fact that this is going to be an effective way of dealing with the problem, and a way which may be necessary, even if regrettably so, in order to protect a person's livelihood. I'm going to pass the...
Thank you, Mayor. Just to mention, somebody's Mark Schwartz, and I teach business ethics at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And very happy to be here tonight and with the distinguished panel. Thank you to Rabbi J. Kelman for helping organizing this event. I'm going to speak about this case study, so just in terms of an academic perspective. So I think we're fortunate to have three different individuals here, Rabbi Asher Meir in terms of the Jewish perspective, Rabbi Lapin in terms of the corporate perspective. I'm approaching from the academic perspective, how I would talk about this sort of case while teaching business students, as I do, and that of course doesn't give permission to people to fall asleep once they hear the word academic, well, no longer any interest. So I'm not going to be referring in terms of Jewish principles, but from moral theory, the sort of principles that one would find in the secular business ethics literature. In terms of blowing the whistle, and this is a topic that I have a very strong personal interest in, and people ask me, you know, why did I get into this field of business ethics, which is a relatively new academic field? And I became a lawyer first before I went for my PhD focusing on the subject of business ethics. And in my year of articling as an articling student, there were a number of things that I saw at the law firm which caused me great concern. And I noticed that at this law firm, there really wasn't a process in place by which one could blow the whistle, essentially, and disclose the problematic practices. And as an articling student, certainly if you do say anything, there's a high risk that you'll be labeled and you're not going to be hired back at the firm. And so in a sense, that was part of a number of reasons which ultimately led me to go on and get my PhD. And when I spoke about the topic of whistleblowing, there are just so many people I discovered that have seen some really horrifying things. I asked my students as one assignment, at the beginning of the semester, to hand in a personal ethical dilemma that they faced. And some of these dilemmas, I would say about 5% deal with very serious, significant issues. Many of them involving situations where the student in a work environment had to decide whether or not to blow the whistle, and sometimes involve actual life or death decisions, possible consequences. So this is a very important topic. Many of you may have been in a work environment where you saw illegality or serious unethical practices and had to make a decision for yourself. Do you disclose this? Maybe you have friends, family members, etc. who have faced the situation. Certainly the studies indicate that many, many people have faced such situations. So now, to get back to this, the case study. So we have here an employee, a former employee was fired for trying to blow the whistle internally, now setting up a computing company, and possible bad-mouthing also going on in terms of the former CEO. Do you blow the whistle? There is a vindictive intent here. And in many ways, the way I would teach it is very similar to the Jewish approach. In other words, I start with the premise that you should not blow the whistle, at least initially. You do have a duty of loyalty, not just to your current employer, but also to a former employer. And that's what you start with. But then you have to ask the question, are there certain conditions where one becomes entitled to blow the whistle, where it becomes permissible? And I would suggest three basic conditions. So number one, is there clear evidence? Some of these are quite similar to the Chavetz Chaim. You have to have clear evidence. You don't blow the whistle just based on conjecture. In this case, I think that appeared to be met. Secondly, that you have made those reasonable attempts to disclose the wrongdoing internally, and certainly in this case, you brought it to the attention of the CEO, the most senior executive, and the result, he was fired. So you certainly did make reasonable attempts. It's the third condition that's, for me, the most troubling and makes this case the most problematic, and that is, it has to be something serious. You don't blow the whistle, certainly externally, unless we're dealing with a serious issue. And as Rabbi Meir mentioned, when you're talking about possible life or death, injury, or even illegality, it becomes quite clear that it's permissible, in some cases maybe even obligatory, especially if you're the only one who knows about this. But we don't have that here. We just have millions of dollars being lost essentially by taxpayers, and we can ask the question, isn't this the government's responsibility in terms of the company, that they should be monitoring the companies that are acting and doing business for the government, and therefore this is not something so serious that one should blow the whistle. But I would suggest that even the third condition, when you're talking about millions of dollars as opposed to hundreds or thousands even, but millions certainly I think crosses that threshold. So in other words, it's morally permissible for this former employee to blow the whistle, not obligatory but permissible. But there's one additional factor that makes this interesting. Can you blow the whistle when it's based on vindictive intent? And certainly when you look at moral philosophers, so just to mention Immanuel Kant, he's one philosopher who would say, no, you can't. Intent is critical. Your motive. You have to have a pure motive. Your motive has to be based on moral duty, as opposed to a concern over the consequences. Others, those who are utilitarians and are only concerned about consequences, would say, no, wait a minute. Motive is irrelevant. What's really important is the fact that you're saving taxpayers millions of dollars, and therefore you must blow the whistle. I think in this case, and just to conclude, I would say that it's certainly morally permissible to blow the whistle, but because of this problematic intent that there is this vindictiveness and that he wouldn't otherwise blow the whistle other than in a sense to get back at his former employer, because of that, this is certainly not something that one would say is praiseworthy. Certainly not something one would jump up and down and say, hey, here we go, you blew the whistle. And there are lots of examples of whistleblowers. Jeffrey Wigand, you may be familiar with, those who saw the movie The Insider. And when you look at his case, you know, certainly in a lot of respects one can call him a hero in terms of what he did and the personal suffering that he ultimately faced. But on the other hand, it was interesting. He knew the information before he was fired. And it was only after getting fired that he really began to raise concerns and went to CBS and was on 60 Minutes, etc. There are questions here in terms of intent and how one should judge a person who blows the whistle when it's simply out of vindictiveness. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Rabbi Lappin.
Thanks, Dr. Schultz. And I'm going to agree with you from a slightly different perspective. The one is, in tying back to some of the comments I made earlier, the Rif brings la halacha. He paskins this as a decision, and others do too. But just as one, as today there aren't people who know how to receive rebuke, there aren't people who know how to give it. And if you can't rebuke people in a way that they can be receptive to, keep quiet. We have an obligation to be effective in our rebuke. There are cases where you have to rebuke irrespective. But those are some of the severe cases that Dr. Schultz talked about. Generally, it's terribly important that there is a receptivity, that you're doing it in a way that somebody can hear. And part of that deals with the motivation. If your motivation is obviously vindictive, of course the rebuke is not going to be heard other than by people who are also out to get the particular person. So the intent here would seem to me to be important. Added to that, if we say that business and markets were divinely created, as I suggested earlier, then markets build in the capacity to punish inefficiencies. You don't have to blow whistles on inefficiency. So stop whining, prove yourself to be more efficient, and get the next government contract. That shouldn't be too difficult. One can use market mechanisms other than vindictiveness if the issues are inefficiencies rather than pure illegalities.
Okay, we are going to open up the questions in a moment, but I just want to make a couple announcements in general. Maybe I should have made it earlier. The purpose of evenings like here are really is to generate interest in the field and not necessarily to answer a specific issue,
but I think is to, we want to create a culture where these are on the agenda of our community and the community in general. And for that end, I really want to, perhaps this is a slightly, you know, a bigger event, but we, I've been talking to a number of people and would like to start, like what they have in Israel, if Machon Lev, sort of an institute of business ethics, with newsletters and speakers and meetings in offices and all kinds of smaller things to encourage us. And I want to thank, in that context, Sheldon Lieberman, who's sitting in the back, who organized a class that I started giving a few months ago at Aird and Burliss, every week, where we have a case on business ethics. I can't plug it because I'm biased, but I see a number of the people who come are here. I mean, these are little things, but they're important things that we come, and anybody who is interested really in the field, I encourage you, we should and I'd like to talk about it, and et cetera. That's really, this is to generate the interest. That sort of is the plug. In general, I want to thank Mark for his work, and really when we thought of this idea, I guess it was back 3 years ago, and Mayor Tamari was our first speaker, who was, of course, is the founder of the Center for Business Ethics at Machon Lev, and all the people over the years from a financial point of view, which is always crucial, but from a sort of a moral point of view, and the people, of course, who come, so I can, you know, go and do these things. So I want to thank you, and hopefully we'll all grow from the experience. That's sort of my plug, and that's it. And as the chair, I'm going to open with a question. While you think of your own question, I ask you to please come up to the microphone. The speakers can address some of the issues here, but I want to ask Rabbi Lapin a question that I found his talk, as I'm sure everybody did, very, very interesting, and really from a different type of a perspective. But I want to raise the issue of Gneivas Das, of basically fooling people. When you tell people that the clothing is not clothing, it's therapy, and the clothing is free, and Coca-Cola is not really Coca-Cola, it's fine. I understand it works, and it's great. But we know in Judaism there is a prohibition of advertising that incites envy. We don't want to create images that aren't. And I'm curious how you would answer that issue, sort of creating false images. And maybe it isn't. I just want to throw out the question to generate a discussion. And then people, please feel free. I hope there are questions. You can say who you're addressing to, or if you want everybody to comment. Okay.
An important question, and the intention is not to one of Gneivas Das at all. On the contrary, the reason why this takes so long, in both of these cases it took 2.5 years to achieve the results, is to make sure that what you're supplying is in fact that by the way the person is treated in the store, they go away feeling a sense of confidence, they go away feeling a sense of enthusiasm. So what you're selling really is the shopping experience. Anybody who goes to an upmarket retailer knows that they are paying a premium for shopping in that particular store, that they could get a similar item, if not an identical item, cheaper at a bargain store. They're paying for the experience. They're paying for the non-material. They're paying for the emotion. They're paying for the same kind of things that one pays therapists for. And they're doing that with their eyes open. What's more important is that that's what they've been given, that that's what they're being supplied with. So the challenge in the fashion retailer or in the Coca-Cola case, the challenge was not in convincing people that that's what they're buying. That people can make their own choice if they want to do that or not. What's important is ensuring that the experience of interaction with employees from that organization left the individual with an experience that was worth more than the mere item that they purchased, that the shopping experience had the value that was being paid for. That is really the emphasis of it, not pretending to have a value, but ensuring by uplifting the quality of the sales personnel and every part of the business that interacts with the customer, ensuring that the customer goes with a non-material benefit that somehow equates in his mind with the premium he's paying.
First of all, I want to say I very much enjoyed the panelists, extremely informative and very enjoyable discussion. I've got a question, I guess, for Rabbi Meir, perhaps, in the issue of reverse, I would call it reverse slander. And I'll give two kind of examples of this. you have a tenant who is very problematic, but because of rental controls or other issues, you can't really remove that tenant. However, that tenant has, for his or her own reasons, found that he would like to move, and you get a call from the new landlord asking for a reference about your tenant. And what should you be saying if you want to encourage this person to leave? And in a similar vein, and in a business world, and I've come across this fairly frequently, problem employees are given glowing recommendations and evaluations so that they'll be promoted out of their job and into another department. So I want your comments on both of these reverse slander issues.
This is a very interesting question. It's the it's a well-known phenomenon, the Peter principle, that people are going to get promoted until they're no longer useful. And the other point also is well taken. And to some extent, this problem can be taken care of by the shorthand that we all know about, that a person gets a certain term that is so glowing that a person already figures out what the objective is. One thing I'll just mention is that there is one kind of reverse slander which is explicitly mentioned in the Chafetz Chaim, and that is where you praise somebody to his own detriment. And the example, the classic example is where someone is such a generous host, and you tell everybody what a wonderful host is, and anybody who knocks on his door will be given a lodging and a meal and so on, and then he's overcome by his friends and relatives who come to visit, something like that. So that's one example. But the case that you discuss would not be a case of, in a Jewish law perspective, a case of Lashon Hara, because you're not saying anything nasty about a person, but it would fall into another rubric, which Rabbi Kalman already mentioned, which is called Gneva Dat, where you mislead a person. If you give a person a misleading opinion, then it's always permissible. And the specific case you mentioned falls into a more serious transgression, which we call Lifnei Iver, which the Torah says that we should not put Lifnei Iver Lo Titen Mikshol. A person shouldn't put a stumbling block before the blind. Explanation that Rashi gives is to give someone bad advice in business. He says, Eitza she'ina hogenet lebaaleha, and where you give a person business advice, which is masquerading as objective advice, Rashi says, the person is trying to decide if he wants to sell his field and buy a donkey, he wants to get out of the real estate business and get in the transportation business, and you tell him you think it's a wonderful idea when your real goal is to buy his field. It's not objective advice, and it's masquerading as objective advice, and this is what we call lifnei iver. And I think that the example that we just heard is a classic example that what you're pretending to do is to give objective advice. There's no problem in advising somebody if you reveal your motive. You say, well, you know, I'd love to have your field, why don't you sell it? But if your motive is hidden, then we're in the example of improper advice of lifnei iver, and the case where you try and recommend somebody pretending to be giving objective advice, in fact you have an ulterior motive, is almost an exact parallel to what we find in Rashi's commentary to the prohibition of a stumbling block before the blind.
I'm most impressed this evening. This question is directed to Rabbi Lepin. This is a business case here, which I believe is experienced, there has been experienced or will be experienced by 95% of the people in this room. A religious high school where one has a child is requesting, say, a $500 registration deposit for the next academic year. If it's not paid by, say, March the 31st, an extra $100 is required. If the school does not suffer extra expenses as a result of delayed payment of that $500, is not the extra $100 considered RBIS being dependent on delayed initial payment?
I think that's a very good question, and I got such a letter from the school of my kids. That never struck me. What a brilliant observation. Again, this is not the forum for a psak halacha, an issue like that a posek has to decide on, but there's certainly grounds for a shaila, definitely grounds for a shaila, that to intimate two levels of payment based on a timing issue comes very close to Rubis if it isn't Rubis itself.
As I recall, again, it's with as Rabbi Lok puts out with a check these out. As I recall, it says in the Shulchan Aruch that a one-time fine for late payment can sometimes be permissible, and so that first of all, taking Rabbi Lachman's comment that it's worth a shaila and to be examined. At the same time, one possible reason for leniency is, as I recall, it says that if a person has a one-time, not a constantly growing, mounting interest payment, but a one-time fine for a late payment, I believe that in some cases that can be permitted, and that's something that's also worth checking out.
First of all, I would like to thank the rabbis and everything for the lectures, and it's wonderful. But I think my question is addressed to Rabbi Lapin, and you mentioned that the market inefficiencies, and basically we don't need whistleblowers when there are inefficiencies, right? So what's the view then on monopolies when even there are, like, even if there are inefficiencies, which a monopoly is an inefficiency from the point of view of economics, how do we respond to that?
Torah is not a proponent of monopoly. The Torah is a proponent of free market, and that's part of the reason why. The free market is its own policeman, both from a moral and an efficiency perspective. That doesn't mean there aren't cases where whistleblowing is required, because there's an immediate loss from which you can save somebody. But if the issue is inefficiencies over a period of time, then the free market is the mechanism, and a monopoly is not a monopoly is severely criticized by the Torah, and we go to every effort to avoid them.
People often ask me what I do for a living, and I respond that I make the comfortable uncomfortable and the uncomfortable comfortable. What I'd like to ask is, can you comment on the climate of moral turpitude in yeshivas, where exam stealing is rife and it's done with the tacit, if not open, approval of the administration? Everybody and anybody. Anybody who's willing to answer it honestly.
I think that given that I was the person who opened the topic of Lashon Hara, I think we have to be very careful when we make it very general. So this is one thing that's emphasized in the Chafetz Chaim, that...
I have no problem saying that this is a generality that applies almost universally. And anyone who went to yeshiva will testify to that, including some of the people who are sitting at that table.
Without criticizing the question, that you have to be very, very careful of making excessive generalities. We don't know that Rabbi Lapin brought a case where he felt that the some places where the level of morality is extremely high, and I don't have knowledge of the particular phenomenon one way or the other, but I think we all have to be careful of making unnecessary generalities when he's running to solve things.
So. I'll put my Eilig Noilam Haba down on the line if that's not true universally.
Well, you know, nobody would want to put you at risk, but the...
I am absolutely positive that this is true.
All we need to say is that in the event that a particular teacher or maybe in a yeshiva or any other school encourages tacitly, actively or tacitly, his students to cheat, is not doing a good thing.
But it is a universal problem.
Doesn't make it better.
I don't understand. No one's answering.
Are you asking whether it's right to cheat in an exam?
Why is it a universal problem?
Now you're getting onto existentialism. That's a different discussion. Let's have an evening on that.
Anything but an existential question. It's a very practical question. I'm asking why in yeshivas do people steal exams and lie and cheat? Universally.
No one here is a yeshiva administrator, so it's difficult for us to relate to that.
But everybody here has been to yeshiva?
Where I went, nobody lied and cheated.
What?
Where I went, it was not tolerated.
What planet did you go to?
Actually, I wanted to ask you, sir, and this is the question I have. Sure, can you hear now? Okay. You were saying that, for example, with Coke, there was a sale of an experience. So what kind of separated the experience versus the product itself? Now, what if, for example, you're giving the consumer the experience, but say it's something where, I'm just going to give an example, not to slander anything, but we'll say it's a diet product. And in that diet product, there is a certain, can't remember the name, what it is, but in other words, it's known to be a cancer-causing agent. Thank you. Aspartame. All right. So I'm just wondering, from the point of view of the employee, they know that they're giving the person a positive experience in the sense of they're having some enjoyment. Maybe part of the motivation is diet and staying slim, but yet the employee knows that there is this cancer-causing agent. How does one deal with that ethically from the point of view, of the employee feeling good about what they're doing?
That's a question that goes beyond the example that you've just given. The clearest example of that would be in the tobacco industry, obviously, where you're selling people very unique drug experience that no other drug can really achieve. Nicotine has the amazing capacity to relax the body and alert the mind simultaneously. And that's why yeshiva students love smoking. If we come into the vices of yeshiva students. So there you've got an example of selling a positive experience with a very negative element of content. And leaving beside legislation and everything else that's involved, clearly an employee who has not come to terms with that, and most have not, would find a great deal of difficulty in accessing the heroic within themselves. And in cases like that, should the heroic be accessed? No, it depends if you're the chief executive or shareholder in an organization or you have the public interest, but from a moral perspective, no. We shouldn't be selling things that are causing, that we know to be causing ill effect. If that's the case, definitely we shouldn't, and there's no mitzvah in getting employees all excited about doing so.
Thanks so much.
This is a question for Rabbi Meir. This is a real situation I faced many years ago involving peer review, but it was not like a yearly performance appraisal. Rather, it was something much more serious where one of my co-workers was viewed by senior management as completely incompetent, but they didn't have enough evidence to fire him. So basically, they called a meeting, brought in a senior executive who basically ordered myself and all of my colleagues, and this was in a government legal branch, that we were to document this person. And it wasn't stated expressly, but there was an implied threat that if we didn't cooperate, we might be subject to disciplinary action. ourselves. And so I, along with my colleagues, participated in this exercise. And my involvement was rather minor. I only actually reviewed one document and tried to make my comments completely objective. But I guess the real question is, did I do the right thing in this situation, or should I have said, no, I can't participate, this isn't morally right?
When I get questions that real specific scenarios, I often point out to people that when I write my column, it typically takes me a period of hours when I get a real juicy thing before I am able to, you know, I always tell people, there will never be a question-answer version, a live question-answer version of the Jewish ethicist, because of the immense amount of thought and research that it usually takes to get a good answer, because just because the questions really are worth asking and worth answering properly, it's very difficult. But one consideration that could be mentioned here is the question of whether a person is taking sides. In other words, the normal situation that the Chafetz Chaim is talking about is where one side is in danger of being harmed by the other, and then a person has a certain obligation to go to their help, even if it involves badmouthing somebody else. And then, of course, to counterbalance that, he has all the safeguards that we have so a person doesn't speak Lashon Hara improperly. But in a case where we are taking sides in a dispute where both sides have valid claims against the other, then the conditions are completely different, and it's not really appropriate. If what's really desired in that case is not one side informing the other, but really more of a quasi-judicial procedure. And it sounds like, from what you're telling me, again, I have very little information, that what was more called for in the situation that you're talking about, where there's a lot of uncertainties, and apparently there are claims in both situations, would be something more open and more, it's not improper to provide information that will enable a good judgment to be received. But in the case where a person is really being judged, that's what you're talking about, mm-hmm. We know that people are judged in trial, that people are judged in trial, people do have to provide evidence, but it would be appropriate to make sure that the way in which the information being weighed is one which would give both sides the opportunity to present their side, and nothing that's completely one-sided. And so that would be my basic, you know, I have to obviously, I can't give an actual specific answer, but when we have two sides to a case, and each side has its own claims, then it is necessary for a thing to be adjudicated properly for both sides have their point of view being presented. That's a basic principle of Jewish law. You find in Choshen Mishpat that a person is not even allowed to give advice to one side without hearing the other side of the question. And so that would be how I would, you know, on the tip of the fork, so to speak, to say in Hebrew, to present it. The question is the decision process being based on the documents that I'm being produced going to take both sides into account, or is it only going to take one side into account? And it's only going to take one side into account, then I think that it could be very problematic. And if both sides are going to take into account, then it might, you know, then that could be weighed differently. So.
Okay, thank you.
A little simpler question. Could I direct it to you? To the mic. Sorry, okay. I didn't know you
fine.
Get your name.
Sorry,
yeah. Sorry.
Rabbi Meyer.
Yeah.
Sorry. I guess the question is the insider-outsider relationship for whistleblowing.
Yeah.
It seems to me that normally I was always under the impression that whistleblowing was an insider relationship because an outsider just didn't have enough information and wouldn't be able to make an effective case. What situations would we deal with an outsider relationship for whistleblowing?
The very same. Any information that an insider could get a hold of could theoretically fall into the hands of an outsider, and these are very common cases where if you're talking about, for instance, a company which is polluting, so this is something an insider could know about by looking at documents, or an outsider, these documents could fall into the hands of an outsider, someone could observe it, a reporter could suspect it and do research, and all those cases, I was merely pointing out that in the normal dialogue and discussion about whistleblowing, no one anticipates that anybody from the outside is going to exercise any kind of restraint. And from a theoretical point of view, we might expect that even in that case, if it were possible and practical, then they might also have some benefit to trying to fix the problem within and not without, if that was the most effective way of going about it.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
A couple more questions, and then we'll maybe the
I wanted to address the question of vindictive behavior in whistleblowing. The issue being, you have an example, for example, in tobacco industry, where I forget the gentleman's name that the movie was about. Anyways, The Insider, where Mark, you mentioned that he didn't start the action while being on the inside; that he only started really taking action when he was fired. And therefore classifying that as a vindictive motive. The issue is, and I get different experiences, that there's also a law in Torah that you have to protect yourself, and if you are protecting your family with your job, etc., that you put yourself at risk by whistleblowing, losing your income, etc., which perhaps this gentleman went through. And then when he realized all was lost, now it's time, to go for it, because you got nothing to lose anyways. So I think the question I'm asking is, there's a Torah law for self-preservation, so that when you put yourself at risk at whistleblowing on the inside, and then is it really vindictive motivation to go after the person once you're now on the outside and you got nothing to lose? Is it appropriate behavior?
Since we actually saw the movie, The Insider, Dr. Jeffrey Weiner, okay, a few of you, and some of you may also have seen him. He was on 60 Minutes a number of times. And I heard Jeffrey Weiner speak. He came down to the University of Pennsylvania and he spoke, and it was extremely enlightening in terms of his discussion. For those of you that don't know, in terms of his personal life, he had a $300,000 a year U.S. job, which he lost. He had major health benefits, which were very important in terms of one of his children. He lost those. And ultimately, there was a divorce. It's not clear in terms of the extent of what happened, what contributed to the divorce, but certainly I think was a major factor. And ultimately became a $30,000 a year high school teacher for a number of years. He left that. He's now started his own foundation. He's acting as a consultant. He's acted as a consultant for the Canadian government. So he suffered tremendously in terms of what he did. And actually when he spoke, I should clarify, I hope I didn't come across as labeling his intent as vindictive. It's something that's been raised by others, and I discuss it in class, or the students raise it. He actually said that what triggered him to blow the whistle was one of his children, his daughter, one of his daughters, who actually, he came home one day and his daughter was old enough and understood that he worked for a tobacco company, to say, Daddy, how can you sell cigarettes? How can you do it? And the woman at the front, asked the question, how can you be an employee and work for a company for a tobacco company and produce a product that one would assume by now everyone knows is dangerous and addictive. A little bit on a tangent, I contacted a large Canadian tobacco company and spoke to the public relations manager there and was asking the question in terms of her view in terms of selling a product that's considered to be problematic. And her response was, well, if you're going to criticize us as selling a dangerous and addictive product, well, you also have to criticize McDonald's because they sell Big Macs and they're dangerous and addictive, right? Now, I haven't seen the studies. I mean, it may be that Big Macs are dangerous and addictive. I'm not sure. I haven't seen that evidence. But there may be a rationalization process going on for employees that work at companies like tobacco companies to say, hey, we're doing something okay. And just to go back, Jeffrey Wigand, why was he willing to work for this company? Is an important question. And there was a reason. He was hired, he thought, to produce a safer, less dangerous product. That's the original intent, and quickly discovered, hey, guess what? We're not doing that. In fact, we're producing a more dangerous and more addictive product than I originally thought. So just in terms of the rationalization process and ultimately in terms of his motivation to work for a tobacco company to begin with, he came from a pharmaceutical company. But at the end of the day, to get back to vindictiveness, so I certainly don't want to label what he did in the end if in terms of him being fired, and ultimately I think it was a desire on his part. But there was one other very important point. And those of you, or if you know someone who's in a situation who is thinking of blowing the whistle, there are important steps to take. And I would say, number one, speak to your family. You should not blow the whistle until you know you have your family's support, your spouse, your children, your parents, etc., because guess what? This is probably going to come out. There will be problems for you. You could be fired, harassed, financial problems, all sorts of problems. In Jeffrey Wigand's case, apparently death threats. And it's going to be rough without your family's support. And he also had obligations to his family. Students argue that. Well, didn't he have an obligation to his family? And wasn't he thinking of that? So certainly an issue. You want your family's support, know that they're going to be behind you. You want to speak to a lawyer. You want to document everything. If you can find others to come forward with you, that would be better. And I would argue that at the point you discover wrongdoing, you should also find another job, because you probably will be fired. So get your other job. A lot of people will be blackballed. Get your other job, blow the whistle, and hopefully in the end everything will work out. But certainly steps to take if anyone is considering blowing the whistle.
And last one, you and Arnie.
Since the whistle is just a noise that goes in the air, it is very possible that one who blows the whistle can send an anonymous, not traceable message to the direction that it has to be received. I want to ask a question or just point out there may be a difference between blowing the whistle on an individual or on a company that is throwing waste into the atmosphere understanding that there's a very profound principle in Judaism of Yamin Makariv and Smol Doche, where the right draws near, the left pushes away, where the whistleblowing actually is an encompassment of the two hands are pushing away, and that we try to avoid. The whistle means the person will lose the job, and it could be the end of them, the end of their family, and their future career. The whistle was blown many years ago on a man, and he was incompetent. He could not lift the bucket to squeeze out. He was a custodian in the yeshiva in Tiferes Yerushalayim, and the executive director told Rav Moshe Feinstein, this person cannot do his job. I will fire him. Rav Moshe Feinstein said, because of incompetence, he has to be fired. I need someone to do the job. He said, this janitor who we had for a few years will now sharpen pencils, deliver letters from one teacher to another, whatever, deliver the mail, whatever is necessary. I will not push someone away. This is not talking about someone who did something bad, but it's just the representative of when someone's gone, that's the end of their life and their relationship with the family is lowered, their own self-image. And that's the individual as opposed to something else. So when the individual is there, there's a way of saving them in the job somehow because they're stealing because the standards are, it's acceptable or it's easy to do so, to raise that standards. This is what I'm advocating because the dignity of the individuals with the Torah stresses. Thank you.
You were talking about the consequences of whistleblowing or of our actions of Lashon Hara or anything like that. You seem to be suggesting that, or several of you suggest that it would be clear that if there were lives at stake, then obviously you would have to take some action. But if we're only talking about millions of dollars, then perhaps we have to be thinking about alternatives. In actual fact, in the case which you mentioned, the punishment for the, well, for the person on whom the whistle was blown wasn't that they were executed. I presume they would have had some downturn in their business. They would have had some business repercussions. I mean, aren't we entitled to defend ourselves in a society point of view that we don't want to engage in character assassination for a minor offense, a major repercussion, but a minor offense, a minor repercussion, a larger offense, a large repercussion? Is there no scale with which we can rate whistleblowings? It seems to me that a lot of times in society we've had lots of cases, even in news recently, where whistles have been blown. There seems to be justification for it, and the repercussions on the people who've had the whistles blown on them, well, they have to deal with the effects of their misdemeanors. Not so? Can you do it?
Because you would want to talk about the $1 million versus the small amount, a large
amount. And you're raising a very important question. So, you know, what point is it serious? That's one of the conditions. And that's why I mentioned in terms of Jeffrey Wigand, you know, the consequences to oneself. And one has obligations to themselves and to their families. And if there will be likely repercussions to you and your family, that. That's why, number one, you want to be clear you have evidence that this actually is happening. I mean, if it's conjecture, if you're not completely certain, then you could be destroying them. Right or wrong, you're destroying that person's reputation and affecting their family as well. So you need to be clear, and then you have to go back to working through some sort of formula to figure out, is this a situation where it's permissible to blow the whistle, obligatory to blow the whistle, and then it becomes a personal decision whether or not you're willing to do it at that point.
You know, I think if it's okay, I meant it's a very short question, but I would like to, I feel bad you're at the mic already. Okay, we'll take it.
So it'll be a short question.
Please, no one come up to the mic afterwards. Here privately, I appreciate all the interest. I do like this, but it is getting late.
This is a question that any of the panelists could probably address themselves to, but I teach a course in college marketing, and this past week we dealt with the issue of ethics in advertising. To make a very long story short, there's a case where a local telephone provider who once had a monopoly had lost significant business, and they were running an ad that said, thousands of people are coming back to us every week. What they failed to mention is that there were tens of thousands of people who were also leaving each and every week. Did they have an obligation, a responsibility, an ethical right perhaps to mention in the same ad or perhaps a different ad that as many or more people were leaving than were coming back?
Honesty does not mean telling people everything that is true. It means making sure that everything you tell people is true. We're not obligated to unravel ourselves and reveal our weaknesses, and as long as there was no lie or implied lie in advertising, we're going to have that. Otherwise, it would be difficult to justify the cost of advertising. If every advert told 100% of the truth, and the public needs to be taught how to read an advertisement, just as I think it was Ramey who said that you have to be able to read a recommendation, you have to be able to read an evaluation. We have a way of communicating where an intelligent reader knows how to research and when research is called for. And we can't really expect people to say, don't come and buy my service because you'll be going right against the trend. Tens of thousands of people are leaving me. Why do you want to be the idiot who comes?
I just like to add that I think it's true that a person always wants to focus on what's positive and not want to focus on what's negative. At the same time, if there's an implicit reason, that is a very interesting criterion that Rabbi Aaron Levine puts in his book. He doesn't. Rabbi Lapin was talking about the criterion of the intelligent listener, and I think that Rabbi Levine, in his book Case Studies in Jewish Business Ethics, favors more a criterion which is directed towards the average person. And so, if it's something that more than he gives an example of more than 15% of the people would complete Muslim. A person can easily understand, I certainly agree with Rabbi Lapin, every person can know that the fact that people are coming may also mean that people are leaving, but he gives a 15% criterion. We would say if more than 15% of the people mean that there's a net inflow of customers, then that would be considered a misleading advertisement. As Rabbi Levin points out, people know that people are trying to stack the deck in their own favor, and people are aware that means that our people are coming. There must be a reason for that, and so it's a valid advertisement. At the same time, if we discover that a large fraction of people who will hear it will misunderstand the actual facts that are being represented and think that it means that there are 15,000 people coming on net, then that would be considered according to the criterion which he effectively defends, and that would be considered a misleading advertisement.
I remember those ads, and just does anybody remember Casino Niagara had a campaign? Millions of dollars distributed every day. I don't know if people remember that. And I'm thinking, would a normal person look at that and say, okay, I'm going to go down there? I very likely could be one of those people, right? But what they don't say, tens of millions taken in by the casino every day. So it was one of those situations where you have to ask the reasonable person just automatically, of course, chances are I'm going to lose money when I go to a casino, or does it create some sort of expectation that, look, I'm going to be one of those winners?
Rabbi Levine gives a 15% criterion. He gives a... I can recommend his book.
Okay, I want to thank you all, especially our wonderful panel, and thank you that many of you have stayed till 10:45 on a Saturday night, and the pizza stores, I think, are still open for a few hours for those who want, but there are refreshments in the back, and I want to thank you, and hopefully we can grow and implement and discuss these questions as we go forward. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Case Studies in Jewish Business Ethics.